So today I'd like to talk about the second aspect of clear comprehension of suitability. And the Pali term is sapaya, which has this sense both of suitability and beneficial, which brings an interesting overlap with what Gil talked about last night, the clear comprehension of purpose, in which that term also can be understood to have this connotation of beneficial. So my understanding of what this suitability means is suitable given the purpose that we're engaging with. So it's related. It's related to the clear comprehension of purpose, and we look at what is suitable for cultivating that purpose. The commentaries give some examples about this. The main flavor of the commentary goes something like, some particular activity, such as visiting a shrine, might be purposeful, might have a good purpose for one's practice. And yet, if at that shrine, for example, there's a kind of a large gathering affair taking place, it may or may not be suitable for a particular practitioner. The commentaries say, if you would find that greed or aversion would arise in terms of entering into that kind of large gathering of people at the shrine, then it is not a suitable place for you to go to practice. So while it may have purpose, it may not be suitable. So to me, this brings in the connotation of looking at, with respect to our purpose, we need to look at how our practice is suitable given our current state of mind, given the current conditions in the environment, given our skills and our strengths. So essentially the context in which we're practicing, to look at the context of our practice, that while we may be engaged in an activity that is directed towards our aim, towards our purpose, it's directed towards that highest aspiration, there may be suitable and unsuitable ways in which to engage in those practices. So I'd like to explore this suitability from a couple different perspectives today. Just looking at another way to explore this idea of suitability is to look at a word that sounds related, although I wasn't able to discern to find out whether it actually is etymologically related to the word for suitability, sapaya. There's a word, upaya, which means essentially suitability. It's used in the term upaya kosala, meaning skillful means. And so I'd like to look at this practice of suitability through looking at skillful means, how we engage skillfully in our practice. The first area I'd like to look at skillful means in is in using our effort and our energy. It's purposeful, it's beneficial to apply effort towards the practice. There may be skillful ways and unskillful ways to do that, given the circumstances. So I'd like to explore some of the things I've learned about skillfulness in applying effort and energy. The teaching on wise effort is a helpful reflection on this topic. Wise effort essentially encourages us to cultivate the skillful and let go of the unskillful. Wise effort has these four aspects of avoiding or protecting oneself from unwholesome states, or abandoning unwholesome states. On the other side, it's got the intention towards the effort directed towards the cultivation of wholesome states and the maintaining of wholesome states. So on the, just thinking about that, this sounds like it's suitable means, and it is suitable means to engage in wise effort. And yet there may be some subtleties that we can look at or explore around how we practice wise effort. So for instance, around the exploration of avoiding unwholesome states. So the teaching says, avoid unwholesome states that have not arisen. So for instance, you might know for yourself that a particular situation creates irritation in your mind. You know, like being at the end of that long lunch line, maybe there's irritation or impatience, something along those lines. So there might be, okay, the wise effort teaches me to avoid unwholesome states, so I should avoid that lunch line, that long lunch line. Now that may well be suitable. That may well be skillful for you. What's key here is to look into how we're engaging with that practice, how we're engaging with that avoiding. So are we avoiding that long lunch line because we so can't stand the irritation that we just that we're essentially avoiding the long lunch line out of aversion to the irritation or frustration? So that's a place to explore as we're engaged in the practices of wise effort. You know, in our practice of looking at difficult states of mind in particular, looking at anger, frustration, irritation, annoyance, hostility, boredom. Sometimes there's a kind of a impulse or sense that, well, that's arising. I'm supposed to avoid that, so let me push it aside, you know, kind of with a sense of go away and put my attention, you know, do something else. Again, while it can be very skillful to do that, the way in which we do that is crucial. This brings up the point Gil was talking about this morning, about looking at how we're engaged in the practice. We can engage with our difficult states of mind. We can engage with avoiding difficult states of mind through that sense of clear, you know, not now. That just say no, compassionate no to an unwholesome state. That can be skillful. And if we're saying a kind of an aversive no to that state, we're cultivating aversion. So this is an exploration for us to make around how we engage with practice. It really comes down to what is our relationship to how we are practicing. Looking at our attitude, the motivation behind our practice. So in that long lunch line, for instance, you could also, as a way to practice wise effort, rather than simply avoiding the lunch line entirely, go stand in that lunch line and observe the irritation. Be interested in, what is this irritation? How does this irritation impact me? How does it make the body feel? What kind of thoughts does it produce in the mind? So being interested in exploring the irritation brings us into a different relationship with the irritation. This is a skillful way of working with a difficult state of mind. Now, in terms of avoiding, you know, if we're thinking, well, how is that avoiding? The teaching on wise effort tells us to avoid unwholesome states of mind, or abandon unwholesome states of mind. How is that abandoning if I'm looking at it? It's kind of an abandoning through letting be. It's an abandoning through not fueling. As we bring our mindful attention to difficulty, we bring mindfulness to that turning towards difficulty. I think we've talked about, you know, the sense of when we have difficult states of mind, we're often focused outwards on the thing we're irritated with. And that kind of attention tends to fuel the difficulty. But we can instead let go of the attention on the thing we're irritated with or annoyed with, and turn towards the experience itself, experience of irritation, whatever the difficult state is itself. And that, I like to think of it kind of disengaging the gears of the fuel for that state. You disengage the gears. Think about what disengaging the gears means. If you're in a car going 60 miles an hour down the freeway and you disengage the gears, that's like putting the car in neutral. You put the car into neutral. The car doesn't stop when you do that, but it will come to a stop because you're no longer fueling it. And this is essentially how the practice of mindfulness works with difficulty, when we recognize the difficulty, just the clear comprehension of that difficulty. The non-reactive, if we can be non-reactively aware of that difficulty, it may not stop immediately, but we've like taken the fuel out of it. And so it will come to a stop. So this is a way of cultivating abandoning. This is a way of cultivating the abandoning. In the maintaining and cultivating wholesome states, again, this is skillful to do, but we can sometimes, again, this is looking at what is our relationship to our practice of cultivating these wholesome states? On one retreat, I was experiencing really, really peaceful, clear states of mind. And the practice at this particular time in my practice was whatever was going on, check my relationship to it. And so I was in this really beautiful, clear, peaceful state of mind, and checked in, well, what's my relationship to this? And I saw the subtlest form of trying to make the state continue. It was just a really quiet form of desire to keep that state going. So as soon as I saw that, the mind let go of that trying to make it continue, and then a couple other layers revealed themselves. Layer of wanting it to continue and fear that it wouldn't if I didn't make that intentionality towards it continuing. So there were just some subtle levels of greed and aversion around there's a little greed around keeping the state going and a little aversion around the fear of it going away. So the when we enter into the place of there being beautiful, wholesome states, sometimes there can be subtle relationships of greed to those states. So just, I really think of this practice of suitability as looking a lot at the suitability given the context of our minds. Are we leaning in to try to create something? Are we pulling away to try to get rid of something in the engagement of our practice? We need to recognize this. So things that are purposeful may have, we can engage in purposeful activity with a greed. We can engage in a purposeful activity with an aversion. And in those situations, we need to take care and look at the suitability of that. Now, this isn't, the real exploration here is not to have an aversive relationship then to seeing the way we're engaged. Like when I notice that, trying to make it continue. Actually, when I noticed that whole thing unfold, I saw the trying to make it continue, watched that fall away, saw the wanting it to continue, watched that fall away, saw the fear. And at that point, I was kind of like, wow, that's amazing. I had no idea there were some hindrances lurking under that really clear mind state. And so I got kind of happy seeing that that had been uncovered through checking into the attitude, checking into the relationship to the experience. Another aspect of the effort, besides this teaching on wise effort, where we look at the suitability of our engagement, is in how we apply our energy, kind of the level of energy that we make. We can be too tight, we can be too lax. The Buddha gave an analogy around this kind of exploration around energy and effort in terms of tuning a lute, the strings on a lute. And he said, when that string is too loose, it won't make music. When that string is too tight, it might snap, and then you can't play the instrument. So that the balance has to be just at the right level of tension on that string in order to make music. And he said, similarly, our effort in practice, the way we engage in our practice, should be neither too tight nor too loose. When it gets too tight, we tend to get restless. Our energy tends to get agitated. When it gets too loose, we tend to get sleepy, dull. So our energy level changes over the day, and we can't just pick a level of effort and say, this is what I'm going to be doing, because the system changes. Our body and mind changes over the day. And the practice changes us as well. So, we can't just say, okay, this is how I'm going to apply my effort. I'm going to really go for it. That may be suitable at certain times of the day. And at other times of the day, it may be way too much. Sometimes of the day, it may be more suitable to back off. At other times of the day, that may just be laziness. So again, looking at our the context in which we're practicing, looking at our minds, looking at our energy level. One time, I was at a retreat and practicing. Gil was my teacher, and I was experiencing these rhythms of the day. Sometimes of the day, I just felt like I had so little energy even to offer the practice. And kind of there was a sense of, I really got to try. I really got to, you know, gear up that energy, as if I was somehow wanting to make the energy so that I could apply that really strong effort. And Gil wisely said to me, make the best effort you can given the circumstances. So that's not a carte blanche to say, oh, just stop practicing when you're tired. But it's also not trying to wind yourself up when the energy is low. Just keep making that steady practice, steady meeting of experience moment after moment. And then the energy level shifts and changes again. So this exploration around effort energy has been one that it's kind of for me been a major exploration and deepening of understanding in my practice of how to apply energy skillfully. It's not hard to make effort. I mean, it's not hard to be mindful. It's not hard to be mindful for a moment. Just right now, you know, are you aware? You can hear the sound of my voice. You're aware of that. You can probably sense the sensations of your hands or the sensations of your buttocks on the chair, or cushion, or bench. Just in my mentioning each of those things, it's probably pretty easy to touch into those experiences. And so that level of mindfulness isn't actually that hard for a moment. What is more challenging is sustaining the attention. And this, I think, is where our relationship to effort gets imbalanced at times. So in a moment, it's not so hard to be mindful, but we're attempting to sustain this mindfulness over time. Sometimes it's like I would sit down at my sitting and it's like, okay, I'm here for 45 minutes. Okay, where's that energy? I'm going to be mindful for 45 minutes. And it'd kind of be like I picked up the entire 45-minute sitting in the first moment of the sitting and tried to bring in the level of energy needed to sustain the attention for 45 minutes. That would exhaust me. What I finally began to learn after a lot of experimentation and a lot of hearing how others worked with things, one of the key teachings that really resonated with me was Joseph Goldstein saying, short moments many times. You don't need to pick up all of the entire sitting in one moment, just enough energy to be present for a half a breath. And then do it again for the next half a breath. And then do it again and again and again. It really doesn't take a lot of effort to sustain the attention for a short time. And then it's just a gentle remembering, reminding, oh, do it again, and do it again, do it again. It's kind of like taking hand over hand on a rope, pulling yourself along, just moment by moment. Moment by moment. I often found that the exhaustion would come in when an idea would come in. So there it is. I'm half a breath, half a breath. That's no problem. Half a breath, half a breath. And then an idea comes in. How many more half breaths until the end of the sitting? Or, you know, how many minutes left? You know, and there the mind gets agitated. Because again, it's projecting into the sense of a long time to have to do this, as opposed to just do this for this moment, just a moment. So the skillfulness around working with our energy and our effort. Now the short moments many times itself changes throughout our practice. As we practice short moments many times, what happens is that a kind of a momentum begins to build, a momentum of mindfulness begins to build. And it's kind of like you begin to roll down the hill, or you know, it's like a snowball that the mindfulness is accumulating. And it becomes easier because it's kind of got its momentum behind it. At that point, when the snowball is already rolling down the hill, there's no point in trying to run down the hill with a snowball and keep pushing it down the hill. So the practice begins to need less of that reminding. So it's really the art of meditation, this exploration around energy. How much effort do we need to put into the practice? If your momentum is going, if the momentum is actually already rolling, and you're going, enough energy for in, enough energy for out, it's like it's adding a level of agitation to the mind when the mind would naturally already be mindful for maybe several breaths in a row. So it's kind of tuning your level of effort to what's happening in your practice. So after my practice began to, you know, during a retreat, when my practice begins to gain some momentum, I often find in my own practice that the habit of making that effort, the habit of keeping that energy going, it kind of begins to get in the way a little bit, but it's hard to stop, or it's hard to back off from. So a question I've learned to ask myself as my mindfulness does gain momentum is, how little effort do I need to make in order to be mindful right now? This is a good kind of question if you tend to be a striver, if you tend to over-effort. How little effort do I need to make to actually be mindful right now? I would notice that, kind of back off. Okay, I don't need to work that hard. Okay, I don't need to work that hard. And let go of the intensity of the practice in a way. The kind of, I'm going to be mindful, kind of that grip we have sometimes to our objects, to our experience. Let go. And seeing, oh, the mindfulness is there. I don't actually have to try quite so hard. And then at some point in that backing off, whew, the mind will wander off. Okay, need a little bit more effort than that. So bringing in this exploration of how to apply our energy and our effort, it changes from hour to hour. Certain times of the day, we may need to bring up the effort a little bit. Certain times of the day, we maybe can settle back. Make the best effort you can given the circumstances. The second area I'd like to explore in terms of skillful means is in terms of working with difficulty in our practice. This is a really important area for us. There's a range of tools that we can use when difficult states arise in our practice. And I talked about this a little bit the other night in answering the question in the evening, the question about anger and is mindfulness enough, or what about that teaching about bearing down with your teeth gritted and just saying no? Skillful means around working with difficulty, again, comes back to looking at what's happening in the context of our practice. What's happening in our minds? Mindfulness is a good tool. It is one of our main tools for working with difficulty. We turn towards our difficulty. We check. The skillful means there is to check, can I be mindful of this without, the first check would be, can I be mindful of this without reactivity? If I'm able to notice, oh, wow, that's anger arising. It kind of looks like this strange tree growing. Wow, look at that. That's so interesting. That's that attitude around looking at the anger is the recognition of the skillfulness of that approach. No need to try to get rid of that. It's already in a space of balance in our minds. Oh, it's just anger. Look at that. Wow. Oh, there it goes. Wow, that's amazing. So if we can recognize the kind of balance, if there's a balance in our mind around the difficulty, mindfulness is enough. We don't need to do anything more than be aware of that experience. Watch it come, persist, fade away. Again, this is looking at our relationship to the experience. There's anger happening. What's my relationship to it? The relationship being perhaps interest, or the relationship being balance of mind. Sometimes a difficulty comes up and we're not balanced. We get reactive. We don't like it. We want to get rid of it. We want to fix it. We want to change it. So if we are reactive, looking at some other skillful means potentially, simple mindfulness of it may not be quite an appropriate practice at that point. If we are observing some difficult state, and the observation, so for instance, a pain in the knee, we've got some pain in the knee, and we're putting our attention on that pain in the knee. And the attitude in our mind isn't something like, wow, look at that, that's really interesting. Feel how that comes and goes and kind of changes. But if instead the attitude in the mind is something like, I'm going to pay attention to that so that it'll go away. I want to pay attention to that so that it will turn into that sparkly feeling, the changing feeling. I spent a lot of time paying attention to my pain with that attitude in my mind. And that's cultivating an aversion. It's cultivating that. I want to get rid of that. I want it to be different. So, you know, the bringing attention to it is purposeful, but maybe in this case not so skillful, not so suitable in that way. So in this case, perhaps bringing in some additional tools. One of the tools in this situation is simply to recognize the relationship we have. So there's the pain in the knee, and I want it to go away. Acknowledging that, acknowledging our relationship is a really helpful tool in our toolkit in working with difficulty. Sometimes that's all that's needed. We can take a step back from the experience itself and recognize, yeah, there's that pain and I don't like it. And that's what's happening in my experience. Not liking is happening. What does not liking feel like? And then that not liking, rather than motivating our behavior, becomes what we are experiencing, what we're recognizing, what we're aware of. Those attitudes can be kind of hidden behind the scenes, motivating our actions, motivating our behaviors, motivating our choices. When they become recognized and present in our minds, we have more of a sense of, we have more of an ability to not be driven around by those attitudes. We can recognize, oh, not liking is happening. Okay. And then there may be an attitude about not liking. Oh, maybe I'm frustrated because I don't like it. Okay, frustration is happening. If we see too much reactivity, if we see layer upon layer of reactivity happening, sometimes there are some other tools we can bring in to the practice of working with difficulty. Sometimes we might be able to find a new perspective, another perspective, bringing in some wisdom, bringing in some skillful perspectives to the experience. So one perspective that I found helpful in difficulty when there's kind of layers of reactivity is kind of take a step back and go, okay, this thing is happening. This whole mess of this difficulty and all this reactivity is happening. And there's a lot of other things happening too. So it's kind of setting the whole experience in a larger container. So there's a difficult experience happening, and there's sight happening, and there's the sensation of my feet on the ground, and there's a sensation of the air on my skin, and there's hearing happening. Oh, and there's that difficulty too. Oh, and there's sight. Just kind of normalizing the experience. Sometimes when we have a difficulty, we can end up with a kind of a narrowed perspective. It's like the difficulty becomes all that there is in the world. Especially in mindfulness practice, sometimes we kind of zoom in on our dukkha. And it's like, yeah, dukkha, that's what I'm supposed to pay attention to. So we zoom in on it, and it's like our whole world becomes that. And sometimes that can exacerbate our reactivity. So bringing a larger container, bringing a bigger perspective, can sometimes help to balance out our minds. Oh, there's depression happening. Oh, and there's the breeze on my cheeks, and there's my feet, and oh, there's that feeling of depression, and then there's the sights, and then there's, oh, there's the bird, and then, oh, there's the depression, so that it's more normalized in a larger container. Another perspective that we can bring is to bring in, actually consciously bring in with thoughts, wisdom, like wisdom perspective. So for instance, this is impermanent. Just a little reminder for ourselves, this thing that's happening right now, it's impermanent. Now, it may not make the difficulty go away. It may not make the reactivity go away. But sometimes when we remind ourselves of some of these truths, the impermanent, unreliable nature of experience, sometimes when we remind ourselves of that, it can just create just a little bit of space around the difficulty and give us enough space to be able to be with that without so much reactivity. Sometimes those were little reminders, this is impermanent, can allow some of the reactivity to reduce a little bit, be a little bit easier to meet the experience with mindfulness. Another one of my favorites is just kind of the reminder, this is dukkha. This is suffering. And I like using the word dukkha. This is the word that the Buddha used in the First Noble Truth. This is suffering. Suffering should be understood. Suffering has a cause. The release of that cause is peace, and there is a path towards the release of suffering. So just that reminder of what's happening right now, the struggle that's happening right now, this is dukkha. For me, that kind of helps me remember, I'm on this path. This is the practice. I'm engaged in this practice that I know has been helpful. So again, it kind of gives a little bit of space around the difficulty. Just reminds me, oh yeah, this is dukkha. This is what the Buddha asked us to understand. Sometimes we can also explore difficulty with some questions. One of my favorite questions around a difficulty is, what purpose is this serving? Because sometimes with difficulty, I mean, we kind of have this assumption or this idea that a difficulty, it's kind of like almost like a cancer or something, you know. It's like what we need to do is take the scalpel and cut all the way around it and take it out. And that's what we think our practice is supposed to do, to excise these things. And it's a big mess and it's really deep and I got to cut the entire thing out or else it's going to come back. So we've got that kind of attitude around our relationship sometimes to these struggles or these difficulties. Sometimes these difficulties are, if you kind of follow the thread or ask this question around, what purpose is this serving? You know, this anger right now, what purpose is this serving? You know, some of it may be, you know, serving the purpose of, well, I'm right, and that person is wrong, and, you know, kind of the sense of liking to be right, that may be one purpose that it's serving. Keeping exploring, you might find that sometimes there's something inside, Gil touched on this, I think, this morning, you know, something in underneath the layers, a purpose it might be serving is, I want to be safe. That it's kind of that the reactivity is coming out of this kind of deeper wish for safety, this deeper wish for happiness. And that wish for happiness has gotten kind of crunched in and convoluted and accreted onto with ideas about, well, there's only one way to be happy, and that's to get what I want and get rid of what I don't want. So that wish for happiness comes associated with a bunch of ideas and beliefs around how to get there. And then there's all kinds of fear around, I'm not going to get it. I'm not going to be able to have that thing that I want, or I'm not going to be able to get rid of that thing that I don't want. So there's more reactivity that gets added on top of it. But at the base, there may be something really tender, that desire for safety, that wish for safety, that aspiration for safety, the aspiration for happiness. The wish for happiness, the wish to be happy, is a wholesome wish. When we can connect sometimes with a purpose like that, you know, I saw on one time I was experiencing a lot of fear. And when I connected, at some point I realized that that fear was really connected to this deep wish for safety for all beings. I was in a situation that was productive of fear, not only for myself, but of more people. And so there was this recognition of, oh, I wish everybody's safe. May everybody be safe. And when I connected to that wish, the heart expanded. The heart was open. And then all the fear of, but it's not possible, I'm not going to be safe, would come crashing in, and the fear would escalate. And then I would reconnect with that deeper wish, just may we be safe, may we be happy. And the heart would open and be at ease. And so I could see, essentially, that the fear and the wish were deeply connected. You know, that I can't just excise the fear. I can't take the scalpel out and excise the fear with that notion of, you know, get rid of that, the whole complex, because often inside there's something that the organism is designed to move towards happiness, towards safety. There's kind of a deep inner longing urge for well-being. And if we're trying to cut out or get rid of something that has that kernel of well-being in the center, the system is not going to go that route very easily. What's more called for is the willingness to meet the difficulty, kind of allow the layers to unwind, unravel in their own way. And we may at some point touch into that tender place in the middle and develop a more skillful relationship with that. And other times, as I said the other day, so those were different skillful means, different tools for working with a difficulty when we're reactive to it. Maybe able to bring some tools to bear on it to allow us to be able to stay present for it. And there are times, as I mentioned the other night, there are times when the momentum, it's kind of like I think of the momentum of that difficulty is so strong that it swamps the momentum of our mindfulness. And any kind of attempt, sometimes I've seen any attempt when a momentum of a difficulty is so strong, an attempt to be mindful of that difficulty just swamps our mindfulness and we end up just looped back into that struggle. So this, again, this is a time for skillful means. We recognize this is not the time to be bringing mindful attention to this difficulty. The difficulty is stronger than my ability to be mindful in this moment, to my ability to be mindful of this experience in this moment. So we learned some skillful means about shifting in that time. Sometimes it may be called for to take a break from the meditation, take a walk, just kind of be a little bit more spacious. You might be able to turn the attention to something else. Just kind of set it aside. So there's this difficulty happening, and you may be able to just recognize, yeah, not now. I see you. I see that you're strong. You're asking for attention. And I also see this is not good circumstances for that. So I'm going to put my attention on this other thing right now. I actually found myself having that kind of a conversation with a difficult part of myself over and over again for a while. So I saw that this particular pattern was so strong that it was really hard to be mindful of. So I kept having that conversation, setting it aside, and I found turning to something neutral really helpful here. That was my skillful means for that situation. I often happened to be walking when this particular difficulty would come up, and I would just turn my attention to the sensations of my feet on the ground. Just that simple thing. Setting the difficulty aside. I even would say to it, you do your thing. I'm not going to try to stop you, but I'm going to put my attention over here. And I actually made a bargain with it. I said, I'll pay attention to you when my mindfulness gets stronger. So that was a way for me to set aside that difficulty without it feeling like an aversive energy. It was just a gentle, not now, and redirecting my attention to something neutral. For myself, I found neutral was the most skillful means when I needed to redirect my attention. Some people find, for instance, metta to be helpful. This is something to look at for yourself. Is that skillful means for you? When there's a difficulty, anger is present. Sometimes it can be really skillful to bring in the quality of metta. It's a traditional antidote to anger is to connect with well-wishing. If you're angry at the person, see if you can connect with well-wishing for that person. For myself, even though that's traditionally in the texts, it's listed as skillful in the texts, it was not skillful for me. Because what I discovered happening in that situation, difficulties happening over here, may I be happy? It'd be like this difficulty would say, wait a minute, you're not paying attention to me and you're wishing happiness? Come on now. So it was kind of like that difficult energy felt dismissed in my mind when I tried bringing in the metta. And so skillful means for me was neutral. Look in your own minds. What is skillful for you? This is really what I hope is the kind of takeaway here from this talk. It varies for different people. It varies at different times. Sometimes various of these tools may be skillful for you. Sometimes conditions change. You don't get a lot of sleep one night, or you get a phone call with some difficult news. That changes the terrain. Something that was skillful yesterday around difficulty may not be skillful today. You don't have the same level of energy. There's other emotions present. So looking at what works, what is skillful for you, through checking into, is the practice balanced? Is there reactivity in the mind in engaging with the practice? So in that case with the difficulty that I was set aside and then trying to do metta and that difficulty kind of flaring up, it's like, that was a pretty clear signal, This is not the approach that's called for right now. So there's a lot of other ways to explore suitability in practice. There's suitability around the particular practices we choose and how we engage in them. So, you know, just a quick example along these lines. I'm not going to have the time to do a full exploration of this particular topic, but just to give you a flavor of this. At some point, early in my practice, really early in my practice, I kind of recognized concentration practice hooked into my really strong habit of wanting to do, wanting to accomplish, wanting to be good at, wanting to do it right, wanting to be seen as accomplished. I mean, there were like clear, you know, numbers associated with concentration. It's like you get to this stage and that stage and that stage, like check, check, check. I could see that trying to do that was not so skillful for my particular configuration of mind. So I practiced a lot of mindfulness practice, a lot of awareness practice. And then at some point in my practice, after having done quite a bit of open awareness practice, I came back and recognized, wow, you know, the mind seems to be much less engaged in that striving, that needing to do it right and be good at. And there was this movement towards concentration, movement towards engaging with concentration practice. It's like, I think this mind is ready for this now. So I began working with concentration practice. And I certainly could do that. I mean, it was a skillful practice for me. And what did seem to happen, though, was that this mind and body had a lot of kind of, I don't know, inner blockages or something. And concentration practice seems to, it's a purification practice. It's gonna kind of allow or open some of those blockages. And what I discovered is engaging in concentration practice for long stretches of time, those blockages would come like begin to open, and the energy level would be so strong that it was very difficult to stay balanced in the concentration. And so I would practice for a while doing the concentration, and then the energy would get really strong, and it was clear to me, okay, you know, concentration is not appropriate right now, so I'm just going to go back to my open awareness practice. So I would do this kind of over days. I would practice 3 or 4 days of concentration, then the energy would start to go kind of crazy, and I'd balance out with the awareness practice. And then I'd go back to the concentration, and I noticed when I'd go back to the concentration that after doing the open awareness practice, after just receiving, not directing the attention so much, but just the open awareness practice that I do is one simply of receiving experience. It's not of choosing where to put the attention. It's just noticing what's happening, what's unfolding. And I would notice when I went back to the concentration practice that concentration was really easy. It was like it just unfolded so easily. And then after a couple days, it started getting weird again. I'll go, okay, I'll spend a couple days with open awareness. And at some point, I got the idea or the clear sign that a skillful means, rather than letting the concentration get to the place where the energy kind of went through the roof and the mind and the mind-body system got so imbalanced, I got the idea of maybe I should integrate it more rather than like 3 days of concentration, a day of open awareness, 3 days of concentration, a day of openness awareness. How about starting every sitting with open awareness and then moving to concentration? And that really began to balance out my practice. So for me, this was skillful means. How to engage in the practice. The choice of the concentration was skillful, was a beneficial purposeful activity. And then it's learning how skillfully to engage with that practice. So there's a lot of exploration along these lines. One piece that I like to offer people, sometimes we think, okay, this is the area I'm weaker in. So yeah, I'm pretty okay at practice while I'm in movement. But when I sit down and I try to concentrate, that doesn't work very well. So that's obviously where I need to work. That's what I need to do. That's where I need to practice. So we tend to pick our areas where we're see our weaknesses and try to go right there to cultivate the practices that would develop those areas. And what I've seen for myself is that trying to go right to the areas of our weakness in practice often can lead to some kinds of imbalance in how we engage with that practice. There can be striving, there can be desire. It's like we want to accomplish that, we want to fix it, we want to change it, we want to be good at that. So there's all of that agenda going in that practice. So this, again, the attitude. What I've seen helpful is to, it's like what I've seen is that all of the practices kind of come in and meet. So mindfulness practice cultivates certain aspects of the mind. Concentration cultivates certain aspects of the mind. Metta cultivates certain aspects of the mind. All of these practices kind of find a place to meet in the middle. And if we start from the terrain, from the doorway where we're strong, we start from the doorway where we have that connection, where it's easier to practice, rather than saying, well, that's easy, so I don't need to work on that anymore, so let me go do that. If we start where it's more natural and then kind of build a bridge to the other areas. So this is kind of my example around the concentration and the open awareness. I discovered for myself building a bridge to the concentration through what was most natural for my mind, which was the open awareness practice. Building a bridge to it allowed the skillful engagement with it. So starting from where the practice was strong and finding the way in, it's all connected. It's all related. We can find a bridge from any aspect of the Dharma to any other aspect of the Dharma. So the overarching theme here is really that of looking at our relationship to our practice. When there's greed or aversion around how we're practicing, that may not be the most skillful approach at that time. Sometimes it can simply be recognizing the relationship. Other times it may need to, okay, so this practice may not be suitable for me right now. Maybe there's another way to engage. It's really individual. There's no one right answer for everybody. No one answer for an individual even. Things change so much. Conditions change, our minds change. So this continual looking at what's suitable in this moment. So let's just sit for a moment.